The following podcast of the STR radio program is made possible through the generous support of our listeners. You can support this podcast by going to str.org and making a donation today.
I'm completely operational and all my circuits are functioning perfectly.
Well, that's a good description of me today. I'm ready to go. Hello, friends. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. That will be host and show. Greg Kokel, host. That's me. Stand to Reason, the show. Glad to be here and glad you're here with me. And I'm looking forward to the next 3 hours of thoughtful interaction with you. My number, 1-800-227-5278. You're in the 714 area code, 754-4150 is the local number. We are getting pretty close to the last show of our 23rd year, I think, right? And that means we're starting our 24th year. Right around February 11th, right? I think that's our anniversary, my anniversary. It wasn't Stand to Reason back then. It was Talk from the Heart, actually, was the name of the show. I had inherited that title from the dear and late friend of mine who just recently went this last year, went to be with the Lord, Rich Bueller. And the Crawford Network put me to work behind a mic for 6 hours a week, three on Saturday, three on Sunday. And now 24 years almost later, I'm still at work and glad to be here. And, of course, the show now has expanded around the country, our second and third hours, that is, but I still have my Southern California audience here, and you're welcome to climb on board, and some are, to talk with me about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. You ask a question, make a comment, raise an issue, give me a piece of your mind, and I will respond in kind, God willing. Last weekend, I was in Montgomery, Alabama, with my good buddies out there, and have continued to build that relationship with the folks at First Baptist Church in Montgomery, and actually got off for an hour and a half of bass fishing on a little pond, believe it or not, in the winter, still caught 11 fish. Not very big, but fun. But while I was at this conference, I had an interesting experience, and that was to hear a talk that I had given essentially dozens and dozens of times in many circumstances on the issue of pro-life, given by a different person who is somewhat of a grandchild spiritually of sorts to Stand to Reason, and yet with the same talk given with a completely different set of illustrations and a little different way of putting it, but I knew what was coming because I was familiar with the entire outline, and it was a blast. I'm speaking to Jay Watts from Life Training Institute. Now, LTI is founded by Scott Klusendorf, who used to be here as Director of Bioethics with Stand to Reason, and for 5 or 6 years, we worked together on the best way to address the issue of abortion. How can we speak most persuasively and develop this material called Making Abortion Unthinkable, The Art of Pro-Life Persuasion? And Scott brought his tremendous experience in this area and acumen to the project. I brought some things myself, and we developed, I think, a very, very effective way of dealing with the issue. And this is characterized in that material. The talk I do is called Only One Question. And here I was, having just given my own presentation at this conference, sitting down listening to the next presentation, Jay Watts comes up and essentially, using a different title, gives the same talk that he had learned from Scott, that Scott and I had worked on together. And so it kind of passed down through the generations. And it was fabulous. Jay was an incredible communicator, and he had tremendous energy and engaged the audience well. And he made essentially my own talk sound a whole lot better than it ever sounds to me when I give it. And maybe that's just the freshness of novelty with the particular details that he used in his approach. But it was really great to hear that. That was just kind of a odd experience, pleasant though for me. It's a kind of a deja vu all over again kind of thing. 1-800-227-5278 is my number. On the flight back, I caught a movie. This is one of those flights on Delta, which isn't my standard carrier. I usually fly with United, and because I'm Platinum with them, I kind of get better seats with more room. I was stuck in the corner for 5 hours in this flight back on Delta. So fortunately, they had the little movie cameras, right? Or the, not cameras, but movie screens right there, and you could kind of roll through the different options and pay your $6 and watch what you like. So since I was so miserable, stuffed in this little spot where I couldn't hardly move, I felt like I was in a coffin. I just ran a couple of movies that I thought would keep me busy, and they did. One of them was End of Shift. It's a movie about, which I'm not recommending, by the way, a movie about two LAPD cops played by Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena. Really powerfully filmed, directed, edited, etc. It's kind of one of these cop movies about South Central where everything's filled with handhelds and actually mini cams that you clip to your shirt, because part of the story was how the Jake Gyllenhaal character is making a movie for a film class he's taken on the side in the junior college or something. So he's filming a lot of what's going on while he's doing his work, looking for guns, drugs, and the like, contraband. And so you get a lot of this action kind of from this camera right up close. And his partner's got a camera on it, too. And there's cameras that are underneath the dashboard, so you're looking up at them when they're talking. And there's you got the camera that's on the cop car that takes a picture of everything that's going on. You know, all the squad cars have that nowadays. So when they're in these chases, that's the view. It gives you the feeling of being right there. Now, I said I don't recommend this movie because it's really nasty. It's violent. The language is coarse to the extreme. The things that these policemen have to engage, what they have to encounter, what they have to deal with. I don't even want to talk about them here on the air. They're just gross. Some of you have seen the movie, maybe. This was one of those films after seeing it, I thought, maybe I shouldn't have seen this one. And I have a fairly broad latitude that I provide myself in these things. I actually don't mind films that accurately predict the seamier side, because life is like that. I mean, the Bible depicts that as well. This is the real world. This is part of the real world, I should say. But it's not the kind of thing that it's always good for us to take a close look at. And maybe this was a little too close for me. And there are elements in it that speak truthfully about the nature of the world. For one, I think it was an accurate portrayal about what goes on in South Central. I read a longish article in some magazine a couple months ago regarding an interview with Jake Gyllenhaal on this film and his what he had to bring to it as an actor and the like. And so I had a little bit of background to it. So I was interested in seeing it. And when I saw it, just got immersed in this stuff. Now, the reason I'm telling you about this movie is not because I want you to see it. It's because of a feeling that one is left with when they are kind of immersed in an environment like this. Now, I was immersed in that environment through the medium of film, but people are immersed in environments like that, or in environments that cause one to reflect on a certain thing that I'm going to talk about. People are in those circumstances a lot. People who are in battle or in war, people who travel to other places that are very different than home, third world countries, places where situations in which you enter into another person's world and kind of see it from the inside. And certainly this movie was that. That was the effectiveness of the filmmakers and the actors and the writers and everyone involved. Boy, you were in the middle of it. Now, I don't know if there's any policemen who've seen this film who work in L.A. who can attest to the accuracy of what they experience, but I would not be surprised if what is characterized as the kind of rank-and-file things that some of those cops go through, I would not be surprised if it weren't accurate or close to it. And I have a friend who was a former SWAT sergeant, captain, whatever, in charge, and he had some hairy stories, some things he couldn't even tell me. It's ugly out there. Now, the frame of mind and the reflection that I was referring to that one sometimes has, and this is what I had when I watched the movie, is of my own convictions as a Christian, my own understanding of reality, my own story, or my own commitment, belief commitment to what the big story looks like. God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection. That's the credo line. That's the narrative of Christianity. First God, then man, then a problem that Jesus, becoming a man, solved. He solved it on a cross, and this determines what happens at the final resurrection, the beginning of history, the end of history. That's the big story. That's what I teach. Credo, the story of reality. And the importance of Christians to get their feet set in the story of reality. And then I watch... I want to be careful how I say this. I'll just say it and then qualify it. And then I watch a different reality. Now, I don't actually think that this is literally a different reality, but it certainly is a different world that people experience. And the people in the world that I was in, even though there sometimes are the world that I viewed through that movie, even though there were some references to God and religion and stuff, clearly this didn't inform anything. The lives that were being lived out, the detail of this movie, were treacherous and dark and vicious. When one countenances that for a while, gets immersed in it, it is easy to think, as I did, what does this have to do with some guy in sandals at the other side of the world, 2,000 years ago, saying, "Blessed are the meek." There is a sense in which when we get ourselves immersed in something like that, that other characterizations of reality, in my case the Christian one, seem other. Well, I was going to say otherworldly, but that would be kind of a pun in a sense. I don't mean it that way. I mean, it just seem unreal. Otherworldly in the sense of being unreal, out of touch, disconnected, not related to this that I just saw. And, of course, I was watching this movie, people who were in battle in that wartime situation, and if you've read books about people who lived through this and you've seen or films depicting it, you get the same sense. But it's not just in those circumstances, because there are other films that are milder, or other experiences of other worlds, that is, immersing yourself in a different cultural perspective, that aren't dark and gloomy, but bright and sunshiny and wonderful. And when you're watching this movie, there's no suggestion of the darkness of hell. In movies like End of Shift, there's no brightness of goodness. It's all dark. But other times, there's no everything seems nice and rosy, and there's no reference to God or Jesus, and people are just doing fine without him. And everybody's happy, or at least this is the way it seems. It's depicted in the movie that way. Or maybe we visit people that have no reference to Jesus in their culture whatsoever, and they're carrying on in relationships and living a satisfying life. And once again, it's tempting to think, gee, maybe my world is the fantasy world, because things are so different there. Well, I've had this kind of reflection quite a number of times before, and two additional things come to mind to help bring me on to center. I don't mind questioning my worldview. I don't mind questioning whether I might be fooling myself in what I think or believe. In fact, I don't even do it on purpose. It just happens. It's a natural part of my mental life. But let me tell you what else occurs to me. For one, all of the arguments that I am aware of, that I know of, that I offer in shows like this and other, these are all real to me. And there is nothing that takes place in South Central in a world that may be insulated from all other things, this dark world for some people, that which experience changes the force of those arguments that I have about the historical Jesus and the resurrection, the existence of God, the authority of the Bible, and those kinds of things. Those experiences, as far removed from my understanding of reality, or my cultural experience, may be, that still doesn't change the force of these arguments. These arguments are not influenced by that, which is good. Secondly, it occurred to me that this kind of thing is a universal thing that has to do with human experience, regardless of where you are. Any person in any set of circumstances that is familiar to them and seems right to them, when they go to a entirely foreign environment, whether it's into a different cultural niche, like in your own country, your own larger community, like if I go from Palos Verdes here in Southern California, Thousand Oaks, into South Central, that's kind of local, but we're still in the same state, we're still in the same city largely, but what a big difference. Or if you go traveling somewhere else, all you're made aware of is that there are different experiences that people have. And so there's a sense in which not only does Christianity seem like a weird worldview if you're caught in this world of squalor and violence and darkness, as depicted in the movie End of Shift regarding policemen in South Central, but other things that are actually real seem just as far removed. So you're in that situation. Try to think of somebody in Japan sipping coffee at Starbucks and reading the newspaper. It's hard to imagine that, but that world actually exists, and it's all of those realities obtain. You're just not in touch with them. So there's a certain sense in which I'm thinking, well, even though I'm immersed myself in one kind of little world, which makes my Christian world seem foreign and almost unreal, that doesn't mean that my Christian world is unreal any more than the man sipping coffee in Starbucks in Japan is unreal. It's very different from experience, but still real. The other thing that stood out for me and that helps me in times like this is when I think about not just my emotional reaction to what I saw happening in the film, but the people who are the characters there acting as human beings. That is, the evil that's being done looked evil. It was evil. It was clear that it was evil. And when the policeman rescued children from a burning building at risk to their own lives, that was good. It was virtuous. They got a medal for it. They should have got a medal for it. So what I'm saying is, even in these circumstances that seem so far removed from the man from Galilee, there are the particulars of the worldview of Jesus of Nazareth playing themselves out very naturally. The dignity of man and the cruelty of man, the ugliness of sin, the nobility of individuals doing self-sacrifice. Now, what worldview makes sense of that? The Christian worldview does. Some others might, but certainly this one does. So even though there's a certain strangeness to that extreme cultural circumstance that I visited as a viewer of the film, still embedded in all of that stuff were all kinds of things that completely fit my convictions as a follower of Christ. Now, these people didn't know or didn't take seriously the offer of forgiveness that is made to people who are thoroughly and obviously guilty of terrible crimes against God. Here I'm talking about. They didn't. It wasn't a religious film in that. It just focused in on all of this dark reality. But this dark reality is not just consistent with the Christian worldview, but predicted by it. Some people might ask, well, Sandy Hook, yeah, well, where was God there? How does Christianity explain it? Doesn't explain it, it predicts it. God was where he always was in all of these circumstances, waiting, extending forgiveness until the time when he will put a final end to all of this, but at that time forgiveness will no longer be available. See? End of watch, not end of shift. Thank you, Melinda. End of watch. Let's see. I can be corrected. I'm teachable. End of watch. Does make me feel a little silly, though, having said end of shift for the last 20 minutes, but that's okay. All right, taking your calls in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel. Stay with us on Stand to Reason.
Want to know what's going on with STR? Speaking events, new resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Post comments and interact with STR staff and other like-minded Christians. You can find all our social media connections at str.org.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. In my Bulletproof podcast this month, I discuss how the problem of evil needs to be answered not just by Christianity, but by every worldview. In addition, I'll discuss why I role-play an atheist, how I role-play, and I'll even let you sit in and listen to a couple of role-plays I've recently done with groups. Look for a new Bulletproof podcast each week on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
I'd like to extend to you an invitation to join with some others who are making a significant difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. And there is a special group of strategic partners who become the solid foundation of STR's ability to work effectively. Strategic partners are just what the name implies, people who've committed their regular financial support for Stand to Reason so that we can plan effectively to take advantage of opportunities for training and equipping. Now, they accomplish this by pledging to make a gift to Stand to Reason each month. If you'd like to become a part of this important group, just call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason today for more information. And we've selected some gifts of appreciation for those who stand with STR monthly as a strategic partner, and we'd like to give them to you. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about, both in the world and in the church, consider becoming a strategic partner today. Training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their faith and values. So call STR at 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason to find out how you can sign up to become a strategic partner. This is one reason why I say that the ideas are more important than the details, because sometimes I get the details wrong. End of watch. Incidentally, just a postscript on my comments as I started the show. And that is what all the point of that reflection largely is to underscore the significance of always being rooted in reality, capital R. Because it is easy to get yourself in isolated circumstances, cultural circumstances, that make the Christian worldview just seem insignificant, out there, frivolous, fanciful. But as I pointed out, when you're in those circumstances, every other view seems fanciful. Every other place in the world that is different than this seems hard to imagine. Like when you're in battle, it's hard to imagine there is a place of peace. People are at home reading newspapers, sipping coffee. But those things exist nevertheless. Those are real nonetheless. And if all the more reason then for us to continue to be tutored on reality, on the Christian worldview, so that we are not tossed to and fro on every wind and wave of experience, thinking that everybody's view is equally true for them, which is nonsense. They can't all be true. Anyway, so end of homily, and let's go to our callers. And in San Ramon, California, Andy. Hello, Andy.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing okay, sir.
Good, good. Hey, I called a couple months ago about making disciples and converts, and you gave me some great, great advice. And so the past 2 months I've been working on kind of a presentation to present to the men's ministry at our church.
Mm-hmm.
And it led to just a great, great discussion. And
I'm glad to hear that. I don't remember the advice I gave you, but I'm glad it bore fruit.
Yeah, it did. And so it led to a discussion that, kind of a difference of opinion or views and ideas. I want to just run them by you
okay. And
see what you think is more biblical. So the goal in our ministry right now has been articulated to encourage men to do the work of ministry, right? Like kind of get them into their spiritual giftings, into mm-hmm. their purposes, and do the work of ministry, right? Mm-hmm. And so that conversation led to a conversation about discipleship and how we disciple Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And so the two ideas, the first view is the view that is opposing kind of my view, per se, which is that we disciple Christians through well-qualified small group leaders, and then the small group leaders disciple and kind of mentor, take them under their wing, and through that unit, that pack, they help discern what the spiritual gifts are, kind of, what mm-hmm. the purposes are, what the wisdom is in that person's life.
Mm-hmm.
And they then connect them to a specialist who can train them. My view was more like, and I could be totally wrong, my view would be more that Christians are discipled by specialists in the church, and they're kind of well-rounded and edified by one another and trained by those as well. So, for example, the worship leader edifies the philosopher, the theologian edifies the, finance mm-hmm. guy or something like that. And we all become more well-rounded.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to be trained by more of specialists than small group leaders. So what is your take on that?
Well, my first reaction is it's not entirely clear to me what the strong line of demarcation is between those two models. The first one I wrote down here, we disciple through well-qualified small group leaders who then help them discover their gifts, and once they get their gifts, then they're discipled in their gifts by a specialist in that area. So if their gift is teaching, then you get a really good teacher who then teaches them how to be better at teaching. Is that the first model?
Yeah.
And the second the second model is, that's what I...
So the second model... which is what I was kind of presenting,
right. Which
is, like, let's say you have 300 guys at a meeting. We basically are training them, like, the emphasis in the group is getting specialists to teach them. Not that they shouldn't be in small groups, because they should for accountability and connection, community, all that stuff, but, like, they learn their doctrine from those who are, theologically equipped.
Mm-hmm.
They learn relationships through those who, have studied a lot on relationships. Because the way I'm seeing it is there's a liability in, unless this man is dynamite, he's going to be more of a generalist kind of his own ideas.
All right, let me try to respond, because I don't know it's an either or there. Let me just back off of those two characterizations and then just offer a more general thought on this. I don't think that the kind of discipleship that we're enjoined to pursue, generally speaking, in the Gospels and the epistles, is that sophisticated at its core? I think it can take, I think it's rather straightforward and more simple at its core, with lots of possible variations. I think as its core, at its core, you have a more mature Christian who is having a personal and direct impact for spiritual growth in a variety of different areas on a less mature Christian in the context of some kind of ongoing relationship. So you have a delta factor. You have a change or a difference in the relationship. It's not peer mentoring. This strikes me as kind of an oxymoron. If they're peers, it's not mentoring. Mentoring is done by somebody who's more capable. So that's the general model of discipleship. Now, sometimes that relationship is what it's going to look like is the older Christian is somebody who also happens to be not only spiritually mature, but good in the area of apologetics. And the younger Christian is somebody who is less spiritually mature and also interested in the area of apologetics. So a lot of the information flow from more mature to less mature is going to have an apologetics kind of flavor to it. And it might be a worship person who's more into worship who is teaching some worship leader. It may be that, you know, that the discipler may have his own areas of expertise, but the place that he is having an impact on the Christian disciple is not in his area of expertise, but in the general area of a spiritual growth, just becoming a better Christian. So you could have a person who has a gift of teaching that is effective in mentoring as a younger brother in Christ, some person who has no gift of teaching at all or any excessive communication capabilities. But the goal is not to make that person a good speaker like the teacher is, but to make him a more mature Christian like the older brother is. So I have a tendency, and maybe you're in this school a little bit, Andy, and the others you're talking to. I'm more left-brained. I'm more anal about things. I like to have a program. I want to have it all worked out so there's no loose ends. And that usually leads to frustration. When I think rather than coming – if I think about coming up with a program, if I don't come up with a program, then I don't do anything. But if I think rather of – I'm an older Christian. I want to have a mentoring impact in some way in the life of younger Christians, maybe Andy. And what Andy and I do is we end up talking once every 2 or 3 months on the telephone for 15 or 20 minutes. That is the radio telephone. And so I'm passing something on to you, Andy. Now, we don't have an extended relationship, but I, in my mind, I'm having a mentoring influence on you. And I have actually heard from many, many people when I meet them face to face that, in the context of Stand to Reason, that I have had a role like that in their life. And I think of so many that have a kind of a long distance mentoring impact in my own life. Now, that isn't to substitute for a more face to face relationships where there's visibility of more particulars in your life. So there's the accountability you mentioned. I'm trying to give the feeling, though, that this is more of a fluid thing, and what is fixed is more the difference of spiritual maturity between mentor and mentee, discipler, disciple, and the intentional flow of information from the first to the second, or the flow of growth.
Right,
and that
right.
takes on all kinds of different flavors. And sometimes if a person realizes their spiritual gift is somehow entails communication, well, then have them hang out with people who are good at communicating and try to learn some things to that. And there's some, you can call it a discipleship of sorts that's going on there as well.
Right. I guess my two reservations, like that to me sounds like, I guess the word, organic was kind of popular in the conversation, which I'm not opposed to.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed it seemed like if we want to have, or my two reservations would be, one, it would take a heck of a long time to really qualify men. You know, when you got 300, 400, 500 people, you know, men that need to be mentored and discipled inside leadership groups. I mean, I know I've been studying apologetics for 5, 6, 7 years, and I just feel like I'm getting my feet wet. You know what I mean? And I've been really, really intentional on it. So,
but see,
I think the lack
is,
of
this
clear,
is our, I'm sorry. Let me just jump in quickly, Andy, just for the sake of time.
Sure.
This is the liability, I think, of being overly anal about it, though, is getting all these qualified men. What are they getting qualified for? Whether they're qualified to fit into the system or the program that you guys have in mind. But you don't need a system or program to disciple people. You don't need this excessive qualification. Look at Andy. If you and I were friends and I was having an influence in your life, there certainly are people that I might notice in your life that I could say, Andy, you got this friend here. You know, have you befriended that person in the Lord? Somebody who's spiritually less mature with an intention of taking whatever it is that you know, and it may not be much, and passing it down. And here I'm not talking about value distinction. I'm just talking about spiritual maturity. Passing it down. In my life, I have had lots of groups of people that I have discipled over the years. But there was never anything like a strict program. We did stuff, and then we taught stuff, and we tried different things, and there was content that was involved. But every group was different. But they were same in the sense that whatever level of maturity I was at, and in the beginning it was really low, there were people who were less mature than I was that I could work in relationship with to bring up to where I was at or closer to it. The higher I moved up in a certain sense in spiritual maturity, the more I could help people grow. But and when you're talking about how are we going to train all of these people, well, that's not, I think, the kind of discipleship that the Scripture describes. There is training involved, but it's not this program. Everybody's got to be certified in the program, so then they've got the skills to go on. I've thought that way a lot, but then I'm overwhelmed by the details. And I'm thinking, gee, if this is the way it has to be, then who's going to get discipled? Instead, what I think happens is there are filial kind of relationships that are like father-son type relationship, mother-daughter type relationship. Paul talks about it in Titus, I think. Older brothers act like fathers and teach the younger men to do this. Older women teach the younger women to do this. This is part of the discipleship enterprise. Whether you teach a credo or five arguments for the existence of God or whatever, it just depends on the circumstances there.
Right. So would this be your advice, like kind of putting words in your mouth just to make sure I got it?
Uh-huh.
Because I feel like I'm having to swallow a hard pill, which would be, for the sake of discipleship, more mature men in the general areas of Christianity would be, you know, effectively and edifying, you know, younger men or less mature men. But I think my personal goal, or what I see lacking in general, you know, Christianity, is that men aren't thinking clearly through a lot of things. So I am overly, you know, I want to train everybody in philosophy, apologetics, and theology, and doctrine, and all these things. And I feel like, man, if we just leave it to let the more mature men, you know, speak into the young man's life, they're missing out on.
Well, Andy, you sound like me, man. What you say resonates with me, but I think. If this is the way we actually pursued the enterprise, it's a recipe for disaster. Just because you can't get everybody up to speed like that. But you can get some people up to speed on some things, and those some things that they get up to speed on, they can pass on to other people.
Okay. So I should just be satisfied if I can get the local body to put the small group leaders through certain apologetics training courses and just hope that resonates. Because otherwise, I'm like, not at a crossroads, but thinking, man, if we're just going to neglect this whole area, then
I don't think we should just neglect it, but I think we have to be realistic in understanding that this is a somewhat of a slipshod kind of affair. That the key to discipleship is hanging out. It's the disciple and disciplee hanging out and being together, and then using the opportunities that you're together for instruction. And sometimes that opportunity for instruction is is organized, like we're going to go through this material because this is some mm-hmm. good stuff. But is it going to be all of the material they need to know? No, they need to know so many things that they could full-time discipleship every single day and they're still not going to get it. That's what you and I want for them, but the task isn't going to be solved that way. We just got to take what we can get. So we are mindful of these different areas we want to try to influence people in, and we don't drop the ball entirely. We don't just say, well, we can't do any of that, so we won't do any. We'll just have some pizza and forget about it. No, well, you do what you can, as much as you can, but if you're looking for utopian perfection in this, you're just, you know, you're going to be dissatisfied.
Okay.
Think about relationships.
Thank you so much, Greg. That really gives me a lot of peace, just in wrestling with it, because I put a lot of work in this thing for 2 months. And, you know, understandably, I don't expect open arms to everything I say, but it really gives me peace.
Well, that's good.
Within my unit.
And my heart resonates with you in this regard. I want the whole world to go through Credo, and then I want them to go through 10 weeks, the Bible fast forward, and then I want them to take the programs of this and that and the other, so they get all their apologetics things squared away, and that's how you get this. And once they get it all done, then they can take it and teach it to somebody else. But it doesn't work like that. Think of it like, I'm just going to give you an image. You've seen these kind of little waterfalls where you have a big vase that's filled with water, which at some point overflows into a smaller vase, which then overflows into a smaller vase and a smaller vase and a smaller vase. Okay, you see that picture of the water flowing there? That's the kind of picture I have in mind. This is an ongoing kind of process of things flowing. And at different times, different water goes into these vases. The idea is to overflow it over into the next vase, which then it gives that vase something to overflow into the one below it. And so everybody's receiving things from the more mature and passing things on to the less mature. That's the organic interaction of the body of Christ. And what that water is, it looks different in different circumstances. You know, mine's going to be tempered or colored or influenced, whatever, by my own gifts and my own background, my own experiences. People are going to get from me something that I can give, but there's other things I'm not going to be able to give them because it's not there to give. You're going to have to get that from somebody else.
Okay.
There was only one perfect discipler, Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah.
All right. But he's a good model. He's a great model.
Yeah.
He's the model.
Yeah.
But he's the perfect model, and we can only approximate that. And it's that flowing one to another, I think, that is that's the core idea of what discipleship is, not any particular body of information or set of programs. Programs play a place.
Thank you
they're
so
good
much.
To work. Okay. Good to talk to you, Andy.
and right.
Yes, sir. And it's an important thing to talk about because this is the way the body gets built up. But it's slipshod, herky-jerky. It's not really tidy. Let's go to break. Back in a moment. I'm Greg Kokel.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
The abortion choice position is flawed on many levels. I talk about a disturbing inconsistency in the view in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Find it on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? STR.org is a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for. Before you turn to Google, log on to STR.org, and you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse the range of topics, from our radio archives to advanced online training to our blog, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from STR.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ and the tactics that will help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. Your visit to STR.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you take a stand for the truth. So visit today. That's STR.org.
Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, the show, with you every Sunday from 2 until 5. Contending for classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Let's see. Sean in New York City. How are you doing, Sean?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Okay. What's on your mind today?
I have a casual friend who I employ irregularly as a freelancer. He's a good guy, very generous, very left politically and philosophically. And somehow, I don't even remember because we are on a heavy deadline, the subject of religion came up. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm not going to believe anything from manuscripts that are 500 or 600 years after the event, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all my lights went off quickly. And I said, well, you know that those facts aren't accurate. And I know from you and Lee Strobel and Hank Hanegraaff that we can prove documents come before 70 AD, at least the original ones. And then he said, well, have you ever read Sam Harris's The God Delusion? And I said, no, I haven't. But we're on deadline. We're going to have to pick this up at another time.
Uh-huh.
I'm very happy with doing that. Now, I know I've heard you speak of this guy's book, but I wonder if you could just give me a primer on the basic arguments and refutations and then follow up about an article you wrote a few weeks ago about a quick conversation you had, because I think it'll have very
I don't think that God Delusion was written by Sam Harris. It was written by Richard Dawkins. Is that right? The God Delusion is Richard Dawkins, and he's the Oxford biologist.
All right, you threw out the name Sam, so I was just trying to remember people.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, if you're asked, Sam Harris is one of the four so-called new atheists, of which Richard Dawkins is one as well. Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett are the other. But then there's other players who have come to the fore in that category broadly who have been making a stir. So the God Delusion, written by Richard Dawkins, is meant to explain a number of things, and one of them is that why God doesn't exist. In fact, this is going to be a little hard because it's a thick book with a lot of things that are said, and then and it's not in front of me, so, and I don't have my notes, but he gives his main argument in about six or seven steps on about a third of the way through his book. So this is a favor that he's done for us, Richard Dawkins, and that is oftentimes when you have a person who is raising a case against someone's view like ours, you have to thread through the verbiage to try to isolate the argument. Well, what is exactly the argument here that is being made to be able to assess the argument? Well, Richard Dawkins actually sketches the argument out for you. The problem is when he actually spells it out, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 premises, which the last one is that God almost certainly does not exist. That's his conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear when you're looking at those things that this is an invalid argument. He just as far as the logic is concerned, there are mistakes that he makes in argumentation that are not sound. Now, it might be that God doesn't exist, but you'd never know that in virtue of the kind of argument that Richard Dawkins offers. His argument doesn't carry the day, and I have actually written a piece called The New Atheist in which I give a generalized response to their case that they make. And I specifically in that piece, it's available, Stand to Reason, and I also, it was a solid ground that I wrote pertaining to the New Atheist, so you can go back in our archives and get that information in solid ground.
Okay.
But I actually spell out the argument that that Richard Dawkins offers to demonstrate that this particular argument simply doesn't go anywhere. And I'm treating the argument with integrity. That is, I'm taking him seriously, and he is, I'm not misrepresenting him. He's the one who says this is his basic argument, lest we miss it. And for all his tirades against religion and God in that book, when he sums up his case in actual syllogistic form, it is clear that his argument is invalid. So you're welcome to go to the website, str.org, and find that solid ground in which I write about that, or get the booklet from us if you want. There are so many different things that are in his book on the God Delusion that might be answered, a challenger could raise. So it's just hard to give a broadside response to Richard Dawkins. That's why
sure, I get that.
Pardon me?
No, I understand. I'll check out the article and be prepared to let Jim try to make his case, because that's one thing I've learned from you.
Sure. Well, good for you. By the way, the enforcers just informed me that it's not on the Internet anymore, because we put it into this booklet called An Ambassador's Guide to the New Atheist. But I think it's like $4 or $5 or $6. It's easy to get, and it's in there. And you could get the God Delusion yourself. Go to the page where he has his argument and take a look at it yourself. It's
no, that's good. I just didn't think I had time to read a whole big book before I brought him back into work again.
No,
so,
well, you don't. You,
summary, that's
like,
great.
Like I said, you don't need to read the book. Just read that argument and then see what you make of it. And whenever you're talking with your friend, then you request of him to be specific about his claim, so you can assess the claims individually on their merits. His reluctance to believe anything from a manuscript written from antiquity, that needs to be examined a little bit, because there are a lot of things. Now, he's making the claim, of course, that these things were written 500 years after they happened. And that is a statement of fact that can be assessed according to the evidence. That isn't true,
no.
That they were written 500 years after they happened. Anyway, those are the kind of things you got to have to pick through.
Okay, so that brings me to this article you wrote a few weeks ago. I've learned, as talking with another coworker, along the similar lines, who says, I can't believe for all, because science has proven God doesn't exist, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I've demonstrated it can, and what I found was really going on was he didn't want to believe because emotionally he really just doesn't want to trust. And it might be because he's a gentleman whose father left the family
sure.
when he was, you know, 5 or 6.
Right.
And there are really more emotional things underneath.
Yes. Right.
And I remember this. I mean, he was using the science as an excuse.
Yes.
Really.
Well, that happens.
And so I'm working on that.
Yeah. Well, a person could have emotional reasons to believe something and have, you know, rational reasons that support the emotional reasons. So there could be a couple of things going on.
Yeah. So I remember in relation to a conversation I once had with my mother, who's a lovely Christian but very liberal in her mm-hmm. Christianity, and I was working on some issues. We were getting nowhere, and finally I said, Mom, if I was able to demonstrate to you, to your full satisfaction, that my point of view is correct, would you be willing to change your mind on this mm-hmm. situation? And her answer was, maybe.
Hmm.
Which, for that question, you're getting it.
Well, it's not surprising, because doesn't that show that it's more than rational things are going on here? Lots of times there are these emotional things sitting in the wings there that are influencing people's decision, and sometimes by clearing away the rational objections that are up front, people then can get back to the other issues, which are a fear of trust or just downright bullheadedness. At the the end of tactics in the last chapter, I talk about 4 or 5 different things that could be going on that cause people to reject the gospel, and these are not all rational, obviously.
So in an article about 3 or 4 weeks ago, you wrote about a quick conversation you had with a similar type of question. And it was your article of the week, I guess, on the website.
Yeah.
And I went back later to try and find it again. I couldn't find it. Can you refresh my mind what that question was?
I do not know, because the article of the week comes up at different times, and it comes up, I announce it, and then I don't manage that information. So I just, there was like a 5-minute witness thing. Maybe that was it. It's called the 5-minute witness.
Something like that.
The 10-minute witness, okay? So Anyway, this is all the time that we have for our show, right? I mean, for our conversation, we're just at the end of the show. But I thank you for the call, a 10-minute witness, and we're going to go to break in just a second here. So at the top of the hour, and I'll be taking your calls, of course, in the beginning of next hour. I have some more things that I want to share with you about my own reflections and things. Are we got 2 minutes now? Or are we going out? Okay, I'm trying to. There it is. I got my clocks mixed up. All right, stay with us for the following 2 hours here of Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel. And welcome to Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel here, your host. Lively right now, just have had an hour of conversation with interesting callers now behind me. And you can catch that at str.org and podcast it if you'd like, or go to iTunes, find Stand to Reason, real easy to download it. Don't want to miss that good stuff. Talked about some spiritual reflections on having seen the movie End of Watch with Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena. I don't recommend it. It's a violent movie. And I wondered after I'd seen it, maybe it was not a good choice for me. But it did get me thinking about some spiritual things. And if you're interested in those comments, check out the podcast from last hour. Next hour, I will be spending the entire hour with Dr. John Soden. He, along with Johnny Miller, has written a book called In the Beginning, We Misunderstood, and the subtitle, Interpreting Genesis 1 in Its Original Context. You want to make sure you listen to that. It's going to be a very interesting conversation. I've read a good portion of the book. I understand the point of view. It's a bit controversial. I'm very intrigued by it, though, and I think you will find it interesting. So be sure to stay with us through to the next hour. Taking your calls, 1-800-227-5278. Spending a lot of time the last week writing an article about theistic evolution. It's called Drifting Towards Darwin. And answering that challenge, that'll be out in a little more than a month, January, February, March 1st. That article, if you receive Solid Ground, right in the middle of it, really fascinated by it. And it's like a lot of things that when I have a challenging issue, like this one is, this is hard. There are a lot of ins and outs. There are Christians who disagree. It's helped me to have to write, to put my ideas down in a clear and direct fashion. Maybe next week I'll talk a little bit more about some of the things I discovered as I wrote it, give you a sneak preview. What I'd like to do here and starting this hour, though, is read something from three centuries ago, 1741 to be precise. I'm not going to give a lot of commentary on it because it's stands alone. I'll tell you the reason why I'm reading it. I'll give you the title in just a moment. My son is a paramedic and was working now full-time, part-time on a ambulance and full-time at the emergency room in our local hospital. Apparently, last night, they had 5 heart attacks come in, which I guess is a lot, and only 3 survived. And so it was hard, you know, dealing with that situation, but I was thinking of the 5 and 3, and it struck me that's actually better than average, because my understanding is that the first indication of heart attack in about half of the cases is sudden death. Or third? Okay, well, so yeah, maybe that's about right, you know. This thing just shows up and you're dead in the case of a significant portion of people. So this was just a reminder to me, as I heard about the activity at the ER last night, of the frailness of life and the realities of reality. That is, once you pass through those doors of death, and I mean when you actually pass through, not when you just kind of stick your foot through and come back. We'll be talking about that, by the way, in February with Gary Habermas, near-death experiences and a lot of these reports and books and TV shows, I Survived, and that kind of stuff, where people had these wonderful experiences and weren't Christians. Said, don't worry about death, no problem. Well, that isn't the thing. Jesus didn't believe that, and certainly not the picture the Scripture gives. But once you go through, and you're through it, and the door slams behind you, so to speak, that's it. And that will not be a pretty picture for most people, because Jesus says that the way is broad that leads to destruction and narrow that leads to life. Now, my understanding is that something like 70 to 80% of the population in this country actually believe in hell, which is good. That's the good news of the statistic. Here's the bad news. Almost no one in that 70 to 80% who believe in hell think they're going there, which, what's wrong with this picture? Now, I don't know the reasons why they don't think they're going there. I don't think I'm going there. But that has nothing to do with me. That has to do, everything to do with the promise of God. So I guess the question is, why do you think you're not going there? That's the important question. In any event, there are a lot of people that are going to be surprised. And so I started thinking about this and realized I had a copy of Jonathan Edwards' incredible sermon from 1741. That's when the colonies were the colonies. Title of this sermon is Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Now, I'm not going to read the whole sermon. It's long. But I chose a couple paragraphs out because, and keep in mind, this is a little bit archaic language. Because as I was cruising through it and reading here and there, these particular paragraphs stood out as particularly powerful in describing not just the reality of hell, but the reality of God's enmity towards all sinners in virtue of our fallen state. And also his description of the frailty, the thin line between life and death. I don't know if most, but there's a whole lot of people who die and die suddenly. One minute they're fine, the next minute they're dead. This could be an accident, it could be a heart attack, who knows? Lots of different ways for people to die. You wake up in the morning and you don't go to bed at night because you're taken. In fact, now as I think about it, this movie I talked about last hour called End of Watch with Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena, there's, well, spoiler alert here, I'm not advising you see it, so this is not a big deal. One of the policemen gets killed under heavy rain of fire. And what they do after the movie's all over, before they run the credits, they say, here's a scene from something that happened earlier that morning. And here they are in the car, the two policemen, joking about some crazy thing, and they're laughing so hard. And the filmmaker is just simply saying, here it is, all sweetness and light and laughter in the morning, and he's a corpse at night. So thinking about that got me thinking about what Jonathan Edwards had written. So let me just read you a few paragraphs. And as I said, keep in mind there's some archaic language here, but I think you get the point. This is mid-stride in his sermon talking about the reality of hell, and the fact is that it's not just that some people are going to go there, but as he starts now, they are already under a sentence of condemnation to hell. And here I read him. They don't only justly deserve to be cast down thither, but the sentence of the law of God, that eternal and immutable rule of righteousness that God has fixed between him and mankind, is gone out against them and stands against them, so that they are bound over already to hell. John 3:18, he that believes not is condemned already. So that every unconverted man properly belongs to hell, that is his place, for from thence he is. John 8:23, you are from below, and thither he is bound. 'Tis the place that justice and God's word and the sentence of his unchangeable law assigns him. Edwards continues, they are now the objects of that very same anger and wrath of God. They are now the objects. He's speaking to people in his congregation. You out there, you thinking hell is later? You are right now the objects of that very same anger and wrath of God that is expressed in the torments of hell. And the reason why you don't go down to hell at each moment is not because God, in whose power you are, is not that he's not very angry with you, as angry as he is with many of those miserable creatures that he is now tormenting in hell, and do there feel and bear the fierceness of his wrath. Yes, God is a great deal more angry with a great numbers of people that are now on earth. Yea, doubtless with many that are now in this congregation, that it may be are at ease and quiet than he is with many of those who are now in the flames of hell. So that it is not because God is unmindful of their wickedness and doesn't resent it, that he doesn't let loose his hand and cut them off. God is not altogether such as one is themselves, though they imagine him to be so. The wrath of God burns against them. Their damnation does not slumber. The pit is prepared. The fire is made ready. The furnace is now hot, ready to receive them. The flames do now rage and glow. The glittering sword is wet and held over them, and the pit hath opened her mouth under them. He continues, that is Jonathan Edwards, it is no security to wicked men for one moment that there are no visible means of death at hand. 'Tis no security to a natural man that he is now in health and that he doesn't see which way he should now immediately go out of the world by an accident, and that there is no visible danger in any respect in his circumstances. The manifold and continual experience of the world in all ages shows that this is no evidence that a man is not on the very brink of eternity, and that the next step won't be into another world. The unseen, unthought of ways and means of persons going suddenly out of the world are innumerable and inconceivable. That's just another way of saying what I said a moment ago. There are lots of ways to die. And die quickly, and die immediately, and die by surprise. He continues, unconverted men walk over the pit of hell on a rotten covering, and there are innumerable places in this covering so weak that they won't bear their weight, and these places are not seen. The arrows of death fly unseen at noonday. The sharpest sight can't discern them. God has so many different unsearchable ways of taking wicked men out of the world and sending them to hell that there is nothing to make it appear that God had need be at the expense of a miracle or go out of the ordinary course of his providence to destroy any wicked man at any moment. All the means that there are of sinners going out of the world are so in God's hands, and so universally, absolutely subject to his power and determination, that it doesn't depend at all on less on the mere will of God where sinners shall at any moment go to hell. So that whatever some have imagined and pretended about promises made to natural men's earnest seeking and knocking, it's plain and manifest that whatever pains a natural man takes in religion, whatever prayers he makes, till he believes in Christ, God is under no manner of obligation to keep him a moment from eternal destruction. And then he's, well, I'm pulling it to a close here with some closing remarks. I'm jumping through his piece, this being Jonathan Edwards and Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. So that thus it is that natural men are held in the hand of God over the pit of hell. They have deserved the fiery pit and are already sentenced to it, and God is dreadfully provoked. His anger is as great towards them as to those that are actually suffering the executions of the fierceness of his wrath in hell, and they have done nothing in the least to appease or abate that anger. Neither is God in the least bound by any promise to hold them up one moment. The fire pent up in their own hearts is struggling to break out, and they have no interest in any mediator. There are no means within reach that can be any security to them. In short, they have no refuge, nothing to take hold of. All that preserves them every moment is the uncovenanted, unobliged forbearance of an incensed God. Not exactly God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life, is it? But, you know, sermons like these were central to the success of the First Great Awakening in the colonies. Straightforward, no-nonsense description of what's at stake. Well, there's a lot more than this. This is just a selection. But it is the selection that struck me as consistent with the observation I was making, thinking about the fact that in the ER last night, five people came in with heart attacks. Only three survived. You never know. People go out fast. And what I appreciated about Edward's perspective is the sentence of hell and damnation doesn't come later. And you don't have to worry about it because you're not there yet. And you can just put it off. Because as he pointed out, we are treading over hell on bark with holes in it. And the only thing that keeps us from crashing through and experiencing the sentence that is already on our heads is simply the forbearance of God. But he could let go any time. So you better get squared away with the provision that he's made through his son Jesus. That is the only covenant that will protect you. That's his point. Wow, powerful. All right, back with your calls in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel.
Want to know what's going on with STR? Speaking events, new resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Post comments and interact with STR staff and other like-minded Christians. You can find all our social media connections at str.org.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. In my Bulletproof podcast this month, I discuss how the problem of evil needs to be answered not just by Christianity, but by every worldview. In addition, I'll discuss why I role-play an atheist, how I role-play, and I'll even let you sit in and listen to a couple of role-plays I've recently done with groups. Look for a new Bulletproof podcast each week on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
I'd like to extend to you an invitation to join with some others who are making a significant difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. And there is a special group of strategic partners who become the solid foundation of STR's ability to work effectively. Strategic partners are just what the name implies, people who've committed their regular financial support for Stand to Reason so that we can plan effectively to take advantage of opportunities for training and equipping. Now, they accomplish this by pledging to make a gift to Stand to Reason each month. If you'd like to become a part of this important group, Just call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason today for more information. And we've selected some gifts of appreciation for those who stand with STR Monthly as a strategic partner, and we'd like to give them to you. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about, both in the world and in the church, consider becoming a strategic partner today. Training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their faith and values. So call STR at 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason to find out how you can sign up to become a strategic partner. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, and still sober-minded from the reading of Jonathan Edwards just a moment ago about sinners in the hands of an angry God, 1741. My understanding is, and I don't know if this is sound or not. I mean, if this is actual or not. But somebody told me that this sermon was actually delivered somewhat in a monotone. Because no histrionics were needed, the prose was so compelling to make the point. So he didn't have to do like I did. I added a little emotion to it because that's just me. But, and I think the topic deserved it. But it, from what I understand, he did not do that when he gave his sermon. But it was so powerful that people were cut to the quick. What must I do? Let's see. Oh, okay. Little announcement here. Looks like we're very soon, within a month or so, we're going to be changing some things about our broadcast, and we are going to be moving our live, which would be a podcast now, to Tuesdays, from 4 until 7. Now, we're not sure exactly when this is going to happen. This is probably not going to affect hardly anybody listening because we will still be broadcasting that during our regular broadcast hours in all markets. But we will be taking calls not on Sundays, but rather on Tuesdays. And part of the reason is to be able to free me up on the weekends, like to go to church maybe or be with my family or do some more traveling, a combination of things. Melinda wants me on the road more. My wife wants me home more. So between the... Sometimes it makes it easier if I'm teaching on Saturday to teach on Sunday as well. So that's gives us that flexibility. But the difference it will make for you is that those of you who call in will be calling in not on Sunday from 2 until 5, but on Tuesdays from 4 until 7. So that's the difference. Now, we'll keep you posted on this. Again, your listening habits will not change. Those who are receiving the program, however they receive it, will continue to do so. And you can continue calling, all of you who call. But you won't be calling on Sundays 2 to 5. You'll be calling on Tuesdays from 4 to 7. And we think that's a chunk of time in there where lots of people can find time to call us. Weekends, people are moving around. Sometimes that's not easy. So I'm just putting that bug in your ear right now. You can kind of make a mental note of that. That's on the horizon. All right, let's go to Riverside and Andrew. Hello, Andrew. Welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hey, Mr. Kokel.
How are you, sir? Good.
Oh, I'm well.
Good.
I wanted to ask you a question about penal substitutionary atonement.
Sure.
I guess the first thing I want to ask is, do you hold to that view of the atonement?
I do.
Okay.
He made him who knew no sin to become sin on our behalf that we might become the righteousness of God in him. Yes.
Okay.
And there's other verses as well, but Jesus died in our place is the point. I think that is the message of the New Testament. There are other aspects of the atonement that might be worthwhile considering, but it minimally, Jesus died in our place, and therefore, because Jesus has been punished, the debt has been paid. Right.
Okay. So, yeah, I've traditionally held to that view as well. It was only just recently, though, that I had a few people challenge me on it, on the justiceness of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm majoring in philosophy, so I have more of one side kind of doing a little bit more rigorous of the, asking me the question of how can a maximally great being who is all good punish someone for something they didn't do. That's not just. So that's basically the initial challenge that I've gotten from just a few people of them asking me, how could penal substitutionary atonement possibly be just?
Okay.
Since someone is getting punished for what they didn't do, that just seems intuitively not just. In fact, some people have seemed to go so far as to say that it's necessarily impossible due to God being all loving, that if he's just, he can't do something like that. Mm-hmm. So I just want to know if you've ever encountered...
I have. Definitely, I've done some thinking about this, and I'm not the response I'm going to give you, I'm not going to guarantee it's going to be fully satisfying to the people who are objecting to it, but there are a couple of little wrinkles here that are very, very important in answering this question. First, I want to ask... let me ask this. Who is doing the judging in this scenario?
I would say God.
God is. Okay. Who is getting judged? Who is the innocent one receiving the punishment?
Christ.
And Christ is who?
God's son.
Christ is God.
Oh, yeah. Well.
But God's son is a synonym for God. It's given the parlance of the New Testament in that culture. So God punishes himself. How is it unloving? How is it inconsistent with maximal love for God to act in such a way as to rescue the one whom he loves and take the painful consequence of the rescue on himself? How is that unloving?
I guess the issue they take with it is it's not necessarily unloving, but that in regards to retribution, people not getting what they deserve.
Well,
that's unjust.
Well, people don't get what they deserve, but the payment has been made. And so now one can construe the issue of retribution in such a way that there is no possibility of forgiveness. If a man has committed a crime and one extends forgiveness to that person, then person can say, wait a minute, that's not just because you are just... By the way, there's a lot of noise in the background, Andrew. I don't know if you can do anything about that. But it sounds like you're in a tumbling around in a dryer or something. So,
sorry, let me see if I can move.
Yeah, so... without tumbling around in the dryer with a whole bunch of other people in there with you drinking cocktails or something. It is possible to are you still with me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, there goes one of the cocktails. It's possible to construe this complaint in such a way that forgiveness becomes an impossibility. Most people think, when reflecting on it, that forgiveness is a virtue of a loving God. Okay? But if we say, well, then under what conditions could a loving God forgive? Well, he just releases somebody of the obligation that is owed them in virtue of their crime. He just lets them go. He's loving. We say, well, wait a minute, that's not just. Because you can't just ignore the crime. The crime has to be paid for. We say, okay, well, then I'll take the punishment. God says, I'll take the punishment for them so the crime gets paid for, and then they can be shown mercy. Oh, no, that's not just either, because a substitute can't take it. The guy who did the bad thing got off. Okay, well, then the only thing that will satisfy that sense of justice is for the bad guy to be punished with no possibility of mercy. And if that's a circumstance, then the person is going to complain, but that's not loving. So you can construe the question in a certain way so that there's no way out anyway. Here's the Christian answer to that problem, that dilemma. It says, yes, God is a God of love and justice. Justice requires that the payment be made for the crime. It can't be just dismissed. Love animates or motivates a desire to find a way out. And so in this case, out of love, God takes the punishment upon himself in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. And he pays the bill. Okay? You get a ticket, Andrew. You're broke. I get dig into my pocket. I pay the ticket. The state is satisfied. They got their money. You're happy and thankful because I did you a favor and you're rescued and I've done something good, and virtue is its own reward. There's nothing wrong with that scenario. It's the same thing here. Man is in desperate need. He got himself into a problem. God is justified in simply punishing him. But since love is part of the equation, love pushes God beyond what is morally obliged, because God isn't obliged to forgive, and he provides mercy that is grounded in an act of self-sacrifice, in which he takes the punishment upon himself. So the punishment pays for the crime, but the one who punishes is the one who is punished. The judge is satisfied with the punishment, therefore justice is satisfied, and the guilty man goes free in virtue of mercy grounded in love. It's a perfect scenario.
So you would say it's not, we should try not to think of it in terms of our kind of our own legal system, I guess, where if there was someone who was found guilty of murder, I couldn't step in and say, well, I will go ahead and serve the sentence for him. And our system would of course say that's no, that can't happen.
No, so that's true.
Say, like, we should.
Well, there.
So you would say we shouldn't really think of the atonement in that terms, basically.
No, well, I think we should think of it in those terms. And in some cases that can be done. I gave the illustration of the parking ticket. The government doesn't care who pays the fine. They just care that the fine is paid. Now, when it comes to the specific of the crime, kind of crime you just identified, the judge in this case, or the law in this case, is not satisfied with a substitute like that. But therefore there is a disanalogy with our own legal system at that point. The important question is the law or the judge representing the law, the one offended, satisfied with the trade? In our government, they are satisfied if somebody pays somebody else's ticket, but they are not satisfied if one person goes to jail for another. However, analogically, hold on. Sorry. Analogically, we think of circumstances in which people do give their lives for other people. Somebody throws himself on a hand grenade. Take me instead, kind of, you know, trade for the hostages or something. Don't take this person, take me. And they're taken there. So there are circumstances in which trades can be made or trades are made. And we generally consider those kinds of trades acts of tremendous nobility and virtue. Supererogatory acts, heroic acts, beyond, above and beyond the call of duty that motivate great compassion and love. So we are not strangers to this kind of thing in human experience. In strict jurisprudence in our culture, that thing can even happen to a certain level, but at another level, the judge is not satisfied with the exchange. But at that point, I'm claiming there you have a disanalogy with what's going on in Scripture, because the most important judge in this whole issue, God, it turns out, is satisfied with taking the payment of his Son, God incarnate, as a satisfaction for the crimes that humans committed against him. And I think that's all that's required. If the judge is satisfied, then fine. Now, you know, if somebody wants to strain at this and say, well, I'm just not going to believe that because that guy's got to be punished. It can't be a substitute, and he can't just dismiss it. Well, for that person, then, mercy is not even possible. In their system, the only system they'd be satisfied with mercy has become impossible because of the way they defined it, which then they could say, well, God is not loving. Well, that's only he's only not loving because you won't let him do the act of love that will solve the problem. Mm-hmm. So the problem there, I think, is how they construe this. I think it is reasonable for us to say that God satisfied the apparent obligations of both love and justice in substitutionary atonement as long as the substitute is God himself. And this, by the way, is one of the reasons that the deity of Christ is theologically critical. Because one cannot say that the cross was an act of God's love if some innocent substitute bore the wrath of the Father. It might be an act of love by the substitute had the substitute chosen to do it freely, but it wouldn't be an act of God. God just beats up some other guy. But if the substitute is God himself, who takes the punishment upon himself, that changes everything.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So wait, what think you?
No, I think that's good. I think that's a good response. It was kind of my intuitions. I've never even really questioned penal substitutionary atonement because it just seemed so intuitive. And it seemed that there's obviously something really special about Christ and God that this interaction is able to happen.
Right.
You know, it certainly didn't strike me as logically necessarily impossible, which is some people are saying that. How could that even be?
No.
Have you found any of the other views of the atonement worth holding, such as the moral view or the ransom view? Or the moral view?
Well, not the ransom from Satan view, because
yeah.
Satan does not own, God does not have to pay off Satan. And so I do not, I think that's an undignified view, given the theological realities. I think that does not reflect the what's going on. And it's a little painful for me to say that C.S. Lewis reflected a little bit of that kind of view in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Satan does not need to be paid off. God is the one offended. It is God is the one who needs to be satisfied. This is why Jesus says, for example, in Matthew chapter 10, don't fear him who can kill the body and not the soul, but fear him who can throw body and soul in hell. And that isn't Satan. That's the Father. So, and when I was reading, I don't know if you heard earlier, when I was reading Edwards, the very last line, I'm digging for it now, is that I read. It says, all that preserves them every moment is the uncovenanted and unobliged forbearance of an incensed God. So the Father is the problem. The real problem is the Father. That's what we ought to be frightened about. And so not Satan. Now, some of the other views of the atonement, I think, are facets. They help reflect certain facets of what the atonement is about, but I wouldn't say that they're at the heart of it. I can't remember all the different views right now, but there may be something to the government theory or the moral view and all of that. But when somebody tries to replace the penal substitution or understanding of the atonement with something of those others, then they've missed it entirely. The reason that Jesus died was as a substitute. That is central. And any denial of that, I think, denies the core of Christianity. Without which not. What is that? An essential. I'm trying to think of a Latin word, but I can't get it right now. So that I think is a central concept.
Just one last thing to add to the discussion. I've had people charge me with if I were to study church history, early church, I would find that the early church didn't hold to a penal view of substitutionary atonement. They they held to a view of the atonement, but it wasn't penal. How much credence do you think should be given to that?
Well, I think the most credence should be from the earliest documents, and the earliest documents are written by people like Paul and Peter and John and Matthew, Mark, and Luke, etc. And my foundation, I think that we have to take, first of all, I'm not sure whether that's actually true. It may be that some held other views, but the church fathers are not divinely inspired. They are certain, they are important witnesses, and we have to take what they say seriously and not frivolously. However, the God's word is the final assessment. And look at the book of 1 Corinthians. It's clear that right during Paul's own time that a whole bunch of Christians got it all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a church that Paul planted and serviced and people he discipled, they still got a whole bunch of stuff wrong. So these kinds of things happened very quickly. In the Jerusalem Council, we have a problem with the Judaizers. These happened during the life of Paul, and Peter himself was taken away with the hypocrisy. So it is the case that very early on, theological trouble was brewing in the church, so we shouldn't be surprised that some of these errors might be picked up by the early church fathers. What one has to stand on ultimately is the witness of Scripture. If what we have is what we think is a fairly clear statement of Scripture regarding things, and also then the support of the church fathers, well, then we're on really substantial ground. If we think our idea of what Scripture teaches is inconsistent with what the majority of the fathers taught, then we have to take a second look and see their reasons and maybe reassess our own interpretation. But look at the early church father. The church soon developed into a bishop type of church leadership. This is not taught in the New Testament. It local elders rule the church, not bishops over regions. So, I mean, right, in my view, right off the bat, they're off to the wrong foot in terms of church government. And this created all kinds of problems down the line with Rome. But I think that there is merit to the observation, and that has to be taken into consideration. Yet it isn't the most decisive element. The decisive element is the text. And if we have strong justification from a straightforward reading of the text that penal substitution is the foundation of the work of the cross, then some fathers didn't hold to that, I'm going to stick with Paul.
Yeah, and I've researched a little bit, and I found that it is the case that there are at least a few of the fathers that held the penal substitution, having read their works and studying. There's this one apologist named William Webster. He's pretty good.
Uh-huh.
And he has entire articles on what the early church taught. And there are a few that do differ. There's not a people make it sound like there's a real consensus on what they believe, and they actually differ in quite a few things.
Yeah. Okay, I thank you for the call, Andrew, and we have to get to break here, and then we'll come back with more questions after this.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
The abortion choice position is flawed on many levels. I talk about a disturbing inconsistency in the view in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Find it on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? str.org is a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for. Before you turn to Google, log on to str.org, and you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse the range of topics, from our radio archives to advanced online training to our blog. You'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ, and the tactics that will help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. Your visit to SDR.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you take a stand for the truth. So visit today. That's SDR.org.
Greg Kokel back at you here on Stand to Reason. Just a reminder that in July, I am going to be participating in the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights in Strasbourg, France. You might be thinking, well, why do I care whether Greg's going to France? Well, you can go with me, kinda. It's actually a two-week program from July 9th through the 20th. It's the 16th, or maybe this is the 17th annual, 17th annual European Summer Study Session in Strasbourg, France, which is like a 16th century city in the core, a huge Gothic cathedral, really fabulous, and a great opportunity to learn. Lots of people have gone through this program 10 years ago, maybe 11 years ago now. I taught there, had a great time. It's one of those situations where you can kind of be immersed in a foreign environment with people of like mind and get lots of stuff in a short period of time, like a lot of intensive instruction, interaction, thinking, reading, and in the context of a essentially medieval European city. Now, that's the center. They got, of course, they got trolley cars and running water and flush toilets and the like, but it's kind of a great combination of the new and the old. If you're interested in participating, this is the enterprise that John Warwick Montgomery founded many years ago, and he is part of the faculty for that those 2 weeks. Go to apologeticsacademy.edu. That would be apologeticsacademy.edu. Did I say EDU? Sorry about that. EU is in Europe, and you'll have all the information there, the times, the teachers, the costs, everything will be there for you. July 9th through the 20th, and maybe I'll see you there. Let's go to Jeremy in Louisville, Kentucky. Hello, Jeremy.
Hey, Greg, how's it going?
Okay, did I talk to you recently?
Not recently. It's been a little while.
Okay, because there was somebody else that I talked to from Louisville maybe a week or two ago, because I remember saying that word. I had to think about how to say it right.
First let me say I was going to say, I need to read some Jonathan Edwards sometime.
Well, you know, I have tried to read some of his stuff, and I have friends that really think he's fabulous, and I'm sure he is, but he has been so hard for me to read. I just haven't, gotten into it. Although this piece was fairly easy and I thought pretty lucid, even with the archaic language in a couple different places, it still, I thought, was compelling enough to read it on the air.
Yeah. I was going to say, great job on the breadboard, by the way.
On the breadboard. Yeah. I have blocked that out of my mind, all that hard work over Christmas to get that done. Yeah, thank you. That's so nice. Many years in the waiting and about a month in the making. But I actually am quite proud of not only the board itself, but the contraption I had to build so that it operated smoothly inside of Belinda's cabinet. It's one of those things where on the face frame you have that wide oval cutout, and then in there somewhere is where that goes, and there's supposed to be a track that it rides on. But you know what I'm talking about. Those things are sometimes really sloppy, and I built this really sophisticated contraption that you slip up underneath there and attach to the bottom of the countertop, and it just perfectly holds, grips that breadboard, so it slides out with nice traction anyway. So now I'm getting beyond probably where I should be right now on this. But, yes, thank you for the compliment.
Oh, no problem. The reason I called today, I had a couple questions. You kind of answered one of them in the last call that you had.
Okay.
But a while back you had a guy that you were talking to on the radio, and I'm not sure exactly what the content of the conversation was, but something that you said kind of made me think about what you meant by that.
Mm-hmm.
You said that you weren't talking about Orthodox Christianity, you were talking about the Bible, and the guy that you just talked to, you said there was differences in church government between Orthodox Christianity and what the Bible actually teaches.
Well, Orthodox Christianity, sometimes when it's capital O, is referring to a denomination, like Russian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, Antiochian Orthodox, or whatever. There are a number of different Russian. Did I say Russian? There are a number of different Orthodox, Eastern right. Orthodoxy, and so they are kind of kin to each other by contrast to the Catholic Church. And the schism happened right around the beginning of the second millennium. It's called the Great Schism, actually, the split.
Yeah, about 1054 or something.
Yeah, like that. And then among the Eastern churches, there are further splits or distinctions, and I mentioned a few of them there. So when one says Orthodox, they need to be clear, and maybe I wasn't, whether they're referring to the Orthodox Church as a denomination, that would be capital O, or to Orthodoxy in general. And then if you mean right. Orthodoxy in general, then there is no distinction. There should be no distinction between what the Bible teaches and what Orthodoxy teaches, because Orthodoxy is meant to reflect the accurate biblical teaching about the most important things.
Yeah, so you're talking at that point about, like, G.K. Chesterton, that type of idea?
Oh, yeah. I suspect he has written a book called Orthodoxy, and I suspect that's what he's talking about. In fact, I'm sure that is. He's Roman Catholic, so he's not talking about Eastern Orthodoxy.
Right.
He's talking
about... Yeah, well, actually, that's what I was kind of referring to, the Eastern Orthodoxy, because my main question was, I've been kind of getting interested into researching aestheticism lately.
Uh-huh.
And I've been researching Eastern Orthodoxy, Orthodox Christianity, recently, and I was just trying to find out, how do you view aestheticism in terms of possible spiritual benefits from a Protestant perspective?
Well, I haven't talked very much about it. I mean, aestheticism is kind of like the artistic merit of something, or the kind of artistic appeal of something, and I think the Eastern churches have a higher emphasis on that, partly because there are icons that are involved, that is pictures or three-dimensional things that are important
to
communicate. You're not talking about that?
Sorry to interrupt you. No, I didn't mean the artistic aspect. The definition of aestheticism describes a lifestyle characterized by abstinence from worldly pleasures. Yeah.
I thought you were talking about aesthetics, and you were talking about
Asceticism,
right? Ascetics, like the church, the desert fathers and things like that.
Yep.
These are people who live with almost nothing and sleep with a rock
right.
under their head and on a bed of nails and that kind of stuff. Okay, not all, of course, do that, but there are ascetics in a lot of different religious orders. Paul speaks to this, and there is a liability to using ascetics as a vehicle for spirituality. Now, while I'm looking this up, and I think it's in Colossians, I don't know it by heart, let me mention that there are certain practices of ascetics that are bona fide and legitimate spiritual practices, like fasting, for example. And fasting, Jesus fasted, there's fasting in the New Testament, there's fasting in the Bible. And so there are times when one deprives himself of something for the spiritual benefit that accrues in the midst of the deprivation, not in virtue of the deprivation, all right? And I don't, frankly, traffic in that a lot. I don't think fasts should be called fasts. I think they should be called slows, because time seems to go so slowly, and I probably could benefit by fasting more often. It's been a long time since I've done that, but I do want to say that kind of deprivation is legitimate in Christian circles. However, a lifestyle of asceticism strikes me as pursuing an end by inappropriate means. Now, I just have a couple minutes here, so I'm going to read very quickly from Colossians chapter 2. And in Colossians 2, starting in verse 20, if you've died with Christ to the elementary principles of the world, why, as if you were living in the world, do you submit yourself to decrees? Decrees, that's like rules here, such as do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, which all refer to things destined to perish, that is, consumables, with use, food, for example, in accordance with the commandments and teachings of men. So the Bible doesn't teach us that. He goes on, verse 23, these are matters which have, to be sure, the appearance of wisdom in self-made religion and self-abasement and severe treatment of the body. Boy, that's a pretty clear picture of what ascetics go through, isn't it? Self-abasement and severe treatment of the body. The scripture doesn't teach this kind of thing as an ordinary part of religion. That's why he calls this a self-made religion, which seems wise, like sounds spiritual to me kind of thing. But then he says, but are of no value against fleshly indulgence. So I think that is a definitive statement by Paul on the ascetic lifestyle. This is not going to help. It looks spiritual, sounds great. It's a man-made system where you are abasing yourself, you severely treat your body, you say, do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, all of these things that God has made for you to do those very things with. And you think it's going to help you spiritually? No. And that's the end of Colossians chapter 2. And I think in Colossians 3, he then goes in to the appropriate spiritual antidote, and that is that we have been raised up with Christ. And therefore we set our things, our mind on things above, not on things that are on earth. Anyway, there's something to think about, Jeremy, and I appreciate the call. Just ahead now, hour number 3, and my guest will be In the Beginning, We Misunderstood is the book, and my guest is John Soden. So stay with us. This is going to be a very interesting conversation. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
Talking to me?
Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, and I am looking forward to this hour. I think it's going to be a stimulating listen for you as well. There is hardly an issue that is more controversial among Christians than what the heck does Genesis 1 mean? Lots of conversation about that, lots of writing about it. In fact, in the last couple of months, maybe end of summer, I finished a book called 7 Days That Divide the World by John Lennox. It's a great title because it describes what is the state of the circumstances between Christians talking about the issue of origins. And it seems to me that As I discussed this with another colleague, it's easier to figure out what didn't take place, in my mind at least, Darwinian evolution, than what actually did take place. If we were there when it happened, the details of Genesis 1, what would we have seen? Now, many think that Genesis 1 gives a very straightforward account of that, and they represent one side. Others think it's not quite that simple, And so in the mix is this discussion about the how we are to take Genesis 1. And I stumbled across a book, and I'm not even sure how I got it. Maybe it was sent to me by a publisher. That sometimes happened. But when I saw it and began paging through it, I said, I got to talk to these guys. It turns out the authors Johnny Miller and John Soden have written a book, In the Beginning, We Misunderstood, which is a great title. I don't know who came up with that, but I have one of the authors with me online now, John Soden. And Dr. Soden, I'm so glad to have you on board. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Greg. Glad to be here.
Was that your title in the beginning, We Misunderstood, or was that the publisher?
No, actually, the publisher came up with that.
See, I've written a few books, and I would never have thought of this title because it's not clever enough. In a certain sense, it doesn't have this kind of, like, pizzazz. It just kind of sticks you a little bit, but it sticks you in a way that made me want to read the book. And that's what matters about titles, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
The subtitle here, Interpreting Genesis 1 in its original context, when I saw that, I thought, oh, I got to see this. Because we have a rule at Stand to Reason. We talk about reading the Bible, and the rule is never read a Bible verse.
Good.
And the point there is you got to understand the context before you can understand the meaning of the individual verse, and so we use that little slogan. But this is something that you have taken seriously when you go to Genesis 1 and have made something like that, understanding the background and the like, the foundational guiding principle of your work. And so why don't we start there? Why don't we start with why you wrote this book and what, from a theological or hermeneutical perspective, was your kind of founding, your first principles?
Sure. Well, we actually wrote the book because of the concern that we have in the local church for the, I don't know if you want to call them culture wars, but certainly interpretive wars mm-hmm. that have divided many churches and individuals over this topic.
It's kind of like the Christian subculture war.
Yeah, it really is.
An intramural fight, but it gets very heated.
Yeah, and it's destructive, and it's not helpful. Usually it focuses on, well, how does this fit with science? Mm-hmm. And we both feel that the real questions need to be, what does this really say?
Mm-hmm.
And for us, what does this say is not, what did we think it said the first time we read it, and what does it sound like to us from our 21st century Western context, mm-hmm. but the real question is, what did God intend the first audience to hear?
Mm-hmm.
Which requires both an understanding of the context in terms of its language and Genesis and all that sort of stuff, but also the context in its historical cultural mm-hmm. background, which unfortunately we are both as a 21st century evangelical audience, we tend to be inadequately mm-hmm. prepared to deal with, and I think we don't even necessarily think of that enough.
Yeah, well, when I read that, in a sense, driving principle there, that we have to go to our text here thinking about who the author was and who the people were that he was writing to and what he was trying to communicate in the context of that cultural circumstance, I thought to myself, no duh. Golly, this is so straightforward and obvious. Why hasn't this been treated like this in the past? I do not recall, I've read quite a few books in this issue, and I do not recall, and maybe there's some out there, any that have been so straightforward in their attempt to take those things into consideration, to lay that foundation before you get in to the interpretive work that makes the difference in the end run. Yours seems to be unique in that regard.
Well, unfortunately, it is a bit unique that way, I'm afraid. I would love to say everybody does it that way, but I was just talking with one of the associate pastors in our church, and he was lamenting the fact that we have people who are learning how to observe and try to think through sort of basic Bible study methods, but they really don't have a hermeneutic that drives them back to context
mm-hmm.
nearly as clearly. And I think that's unfortunately not been clearly communicated always.
Mm-hmm. I think about this I think about this controversy. It's not, and this is one reason it gets heated up a little bit, it's not just about meaning, not the controversy, right, the intramural one, but it's also about commitment to biblical integrity. And I'm thinking, right, of one book now, Refuting Compromise, for example, by Sephardi, which is plays in the discussion, and I'm not putting it down, but the title though is instructive, because for many people, this is one's view is going to be on where you come down on this issue is going to be a measure of whether you're willing to be faithful to the text, at least as they understand it. And so that's another factor here that makes this issue rather difficult.
Well, and it is a factor that continually comes up, and I think we have to say, what is our concern for the text in this, mm-hmm. so that people are not misunderstanding and saying, well, you're just trying to do an end run around what the text really says.
Mm-hmm.
Because the issue is, what does the text really say? But not what does it say to me, but what did God intend it to say when he said it?
Well, you have some autobiographical clips in here from both you and Dr. Miller. And I wonder, can you just give me a little background, give my listeners a little background of where you came from in this particular issue and what got you thinking along the lines you're at now?
Sure. Well, I grew up pretty tied to what was now concerned the six-day creation account.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what I assumed. That was certainly what it sounded like. And in my high school and early college years, I was reading Creation Research Institute materials, Whitcomb and Morris kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I just assumed that that's what it was. And I wasn't terribly excited about it, because I always have figured I was very interested in sciences. I majored in college in sort of a combination physics-chemistry degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always very interested in it, but I always assumed that, it'll all figure out, because science is always looking for truth. And if this is the way it is, then certainly there's going to be some evidence out there.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be able to see it, going to be able to find it. I went on to seminary and ended up studying a lot of Old Testament stuff. That's what I teach, is Old Testament. So as I studied the Hebrew and dialogued with people, I became less and less convinced that this was what it had to say, recognizing, at least it seemed to me, there was room in the text for various things to be understood here. And then as I really began to see some of the background information and some of the comparative studies, it just sort of opened my eyes to what, at least to me, seemed to be a much broader issue here than what I had assumed.
Mm-hmm.
And so in writing the book, I'm trying to help others see that it's not really about how do we fit science into the text or the text into science, but it's really about what issues do we need to deal with in discussing what the text actually meant,
mm-hmm.
and therefore what it means.
I think this little biographical sketch is important because I think it would be tempting for people to think, since you are not advancing in your book a young earth creationist view, that you're hostile to that view and you're trying to dissuade people from what it really says, when in fact you came from that perspective, and as you studied more you realized that you are, if I understand you correctly, that kind of assessment is approaching the text in a way that is foreign to the intent of the text. Would that be fair?
I believe so, yes. And actually, I'm not trying to dissuade anybody from any particular view on the age of the earth. I'm trying to say, let's look at the text in a way that I think is faithful to what God intended.
No, right.
And
the reason I mentioned that I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'll say it first. The reason I mentioned that is because I want to I'm second guessing some of the audience who might be thinking that this is your point of view, when that isn't your point of view at all. It's unrelated to that. And that's what you were about to say. You're trying to approach the text the way the text was intended to be read.
Yes, and my conviction then is that the text isn't dealing with the kinds of details that say it must be young earth,
mm-hmm.
or old earth for that
right.
matter. And so therefore, we need to look for dating and the how-tos in another direction, not
mm-hmm.
in the text of Genesis 1.
Mm-hmm. Okay, can you expand on that just a little bit? Because to me, this is at the heart of your analysis here. You're not, as you mentioned, and we kind of bobbled around there, you're not trying to refute one view or the other. You're trying to make the point that this text doesn't really address those particular issues. It wasn't intended to address those issues. Flesh that out a little bit more for us.
Sure. I'm assuming that this text is addressing the issues that an ancient Israel had as they are leaving Egypt, coming into a place that God had prepared for them in Canaan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming a historical account of an ancient Israel leaving Egypt and coming into Canaan, and I'm assuming that they've been in there over 400 years and
mm-hmm.
that they've been dramatically impacted by the worldview of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should use two words here, the worldview, which would be the whole recognition of how the world is functioning, including the deities that they see, but also the world picture and just how they, that's borrowing a phrase from Jack Collins, but how they understand the connections of the physical world and what that means. So they look at the sky, what do they see? And they don't see a ball spinning in empty space at all. In the ancient Egyptian mindset, they saw all of what we see as space out there, in their mind, was dark, endless, chaotic, watery mass. And this world is a bubble of light and order in the midst of that, just floating around in the midst of that dark water. So very different picture.
Yeah, there's another element, too, that, that you mentioned in the book that I actually had not ever thought about. There, I have had a suspicion that there are some things about Genesis 1 that are that give us a hint that really this is a bit of a polemic about the God of Israel and the master of the universe versus these other options and these other ways of looking at it. And this is why we have, and so you have a juxtaposition there, like this is, you think it's this way, pagan deities, but you know, the sun is God and that kind of stuff, but no, the sun is a thing. And here, so that you got that interaction. What I never thought about, though, is the nature of mission that we kind of presume as we look back in the text, because we know about the call of Abraham and all this other stuff. And then they go to Exodus and then they go to the promised land and all that. It never occurred to me that maybe these tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe of Hebrews know nothing about that or very little, since they have been stuck in this condition for 400 years. And the presence of the Toledoths that we find the generations of, you suggest there are a kind of a reminder of where you came from kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think that God is trying to present with them an entirely different worldview than what they've been inculcated with. We know that they're taking the gods of Egypt with them. Joshua tells us that in Joshua 24. Ezekiel, even as late as Ezekiel, in Ezekiel 23, he rails against them for absorbing the gods of Egypt when they were there. So we see that absorption of the Egyptian worldview, which is very much connected to their understanding of creation, because the issue for Egyptians in creation is really not the material world as much as it is the world of the gods. And so when Genesis 1 presents it as one transcendent God, one God beyond all of creation, not part of creation, and all of this is merely his effortless work, that's a dramatically different, just wildly different viewpoint than what they've been living with.
What about the sense of mission? And you make reference to the Toledoths, these repetition of the phrase in the generations of, it's easy for me to look back on that kind of language and say, yeah, well, this is just the way ancient Jews talked. But you indicate there was maybe a different motive for that.
Sure. Well, what we see as we see the book of Genesis is divided into 12 sections by this Hebrew phrase, Toledot, which means the generations of, or this is the history of, or this is what happened to. And what I see in those, the progression of those 12 sections, is we have the introduction to the whole thing, which is the Genesis 1 account up through 2-3. And then we begin 11 sections that are begun by this, usually translated, these are the generations of, or something along that line. And each of these sections marks a new foray into this is what happened now, what happened next, what happened next, what happened next, so that Israel understands their place really in God's history. And the significance of Genesis 1 is presenting who God is as sort of the king of history and ultimately their king, to whom they must bow and to whom God is binding them by covenant, by Moses, as they're coming out. And so this is really significant for them.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, obviously, or maybe not so obviously, his concern is not particularly just Israel, but it is to use Israel to show the nations who he is.
Right.
That becomes very clear, not only in Genesis 1, but Genesis 12, as he calls Abram, and he sees that his purpose is to bring blessing to all the nations of the earth.
Right, right. Now, how much understand? We're going to have to go to break in just a second here, but I'm wondering, how much understanding of the past do you think that the Jews in captivity had near the time of the Exodus. Did they know they were a chosen people for the kind of purposes that we read about there from Genesis 12 and on? Or do you think this was largely lost and they're being reeducated, or maybe they have some faint understanding in their oral history, but Moses is now coming down and really laying it out in a very clear, directed fashion?
Well, I think there's not a lot of information, but one of the clues that I think we have is in Exodus 3 and 4, where God is calling Moses. He's on the backside of the desert, and of course God interrupts his life with a burning bush, and he comes to him and he says, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and tell Israel I'm Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so I think that's an indication that not only Moses, but Israel itself had an understanding, at least somewhat, of the background and the promises, because they've been crying out to him, and it says that their cries have come to his ears, and he's heard them. Obviously very anthropomorphic. It's not as if he forgot about them, and, But still, I think it's a very strong reminder to them that their roots are real, and the promise is real, and God is going to hear them. Now, how much of that do they remember, and how much do they understand is another question.
Right. And so then Moses is now kind of laying this out piece for piece to kind of reconstruct for them their reason for existence, in a sense, and then give some substance to this long journey that they're going to take to the Promised Land. We have to go to break here, Dr. Soden, but when we return, I want to talk specifically for a bit about Genesis 1 and how we are to understand this, if we are not to understand this, say, scientifically, what you and Dr. Miller think the intention of the author was in that. My guest, Dr. John Soden, I didn't mention that he's got his PhD from Dallas Seminary, but his book is In the Beginning, We Misunderstood, Interpreting Genesis 1 in its Original Context. I'm Greg Kokel. Stay with us on Stand to Reason.
Want to know what's going on with STR? Speaking events, new resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Post comments and interact with STR staff and other like-minded Christians. You can find all our social media connections at str.org.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. In my Bulletproof podcast this month, I discuss how the problem of evil needs to be answered not just by Christianity, but by every worldview. In addition, I'll discuss why I role-play an atheist, how I role-play, and I'll even let you sit in and listen to a couple of role-plays I've recently done with groups. Look for a new Bulletproof podcast each week on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
I'd like to extend to you an invitation to join with some others who are making a significant difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. And there is a special group of strategic partners who become the solid foundation of STR's ability to work effectively. Strategic partners are just what the name implies, people who've committed their regular financial support for Stand to Reason so that we can plan effectively to take advantage of opportunities for training and equipping. Now, they accomplish this by pledging to make a gift to Stand to Reason each month. If you'd like to become a part of this important group, just call 1-800-2-REASON today for more information. And we've selected some gifts of appreciation for those who stand with STR monthly as a strategic partner, and we'd like to give them to you. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about, both in the world and in the church, consider becoming a strategic partner today. Training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their faith and values. So call STR at 1-800-2-REASON to find out how you can sign up to become a strategic partner. Show Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, and my guest today, Dr. John Soden, his book, along with Dr. Johnny Miller, In the Beginning, We Misunderstood, Interpreting Genesis 1 in its Original Context, and I'm just going to recommend this to you. It's an excellent read. It's not a hard one, but it will really get you thinking. It got me thinking about these things in ways that I'd never considered before. And Melinda Penner, the enforcer here, John, and I were just talking during break about how when we go back to things like the Exodus and the law and the Abrahamic covenant and all of these, the theological side of it and New Testament stuff, we're trying to think in terms of what is the situation in which these things were written and what were they speaking to and who is the audience. But it's like we never really asked the question quite the same way about the book of Genesis, and particularly the opening chapters of Genesis. And this was one of the things that was a real eye-opener for me in your book, is you're asking that. Who's writing this? Moses to who? Well, these people who have been under Egyptian influence, the influence of their teaching, their religion, their cosmology, and all of this other stuff, and quite likely have not been tutored in the details that we know of in the book of Genesis about the covenants and Abraham and all the rest. And so they need to be brought up to speed.
Right. I think there's a lot of learning that they needed, for sure.
Yeah, and us as well. So, but now this changes things. And as I worked through your book, there were a number of things that in Genesis 1 that were clues to you that that this wasn't a straightforward chronology that could be assessed in a scientific fashion. Can you talk to me about some of those clues?
Sure. As you read Genesis 1, at least for me, it has been, there's just been a lot of questions, because it raises issues that we can't figure out how to address.
Mm-hmm.
So as you read through it and you think, well, what about Genesis 1:2? Why does he start there with the earth being formless and void and darkness is over the surface of the earth? Mm-hmm. It's as if he begins with this kind of odd incompleteness in which he wants to bring completeness or something.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that, he does things like separate light from darkness. How do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
I never thought of that question until I saw it asked in your book, because it is, how do you separate light from darkness? You're right. It seems like a category error.
Yeah.
So what's up with that?
And some of these. Go ahead.
No, I was like this when you read the statement separating darkness from light. You think what's up with that? You know, that's how can that be?
For sure. And things like we've asked this question for a long time, but how can you have light before the sun? So you've got light in day one, and yet you don't have the sun until day four, and you're thinking, well, what is that? And so people have had various answers for that.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, well, what would they have thought of?
Mm-hmm.
How do you separate the waters above from the waters below? What is that really talking about? Even in their context, but even in ours, if we're trying to think scientifically, what on earth is that? You know, what's the waters above and the waters below?
Mm-hmm.
We read through these things, and there's lots of questions like that. Some of the questions have been seen more than others, so there's a different order of events, or so it would seem if you just read it straight through from Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and some of these other.
There appears to be there are some differences that, you know, that might be reconcilable between the two. I haven't struggled too much with the difference between chapter 1 and chapter 2, because it seems like you've got it's kind of like an isolated camera that's zooming in on the particular event, like at a football game. You know, it's looking at the play, the handoff, whatever, and so you get more detail, and the order isn't quite the same, but it just didn't strike me as significant there. But your book has got me thinking a little differently even about that particular issue.
Yeah, so I guess adding up all those questions to me, it's like, you know, we've been struggling with some of these things, and we've been trying to figure them out. Some of them we don't see as clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So the Hebrew text has some questions that we in the English text don't hear as well. So the enumerating of the days is very unusual, that sort of thing, and I mentioned that a little bit. But as we begin to add those things up, it dawns on me that, you know what, there's enough clues here that we ought to say, are we really understanding this right, or is there something we're missing?
Mm-hmm.
And what I think we're missing is the cultural background.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's
when
they would have heard.
We'll get to that in just a second. When I was when I was reading through this, there's a lot of debate on whether the word day, yom, it means literal day or not. And this can be back and forth, because there are different ways to understand day. And there, you know, how can you have a day without a sun? Well, you can still have 24 hours in God's timekeeping, if you will, even though the sun isn't there to measure it. Well, that makes a bit of sense to me. But it struck me, though, that even though you can have 24 hours past, that is that amount of time, even though you don't have a sun that marks the passage of time, you can't have morning and evening.
Right.
Because morning is the rising of the sun, and evening is the setting of the sun. And there are some places on this globe which at some times of the year have no mornings at all, because they have continuous light, and some have no evenings at all, because they have continuous darkness. And so morning and evening, taken in a straightforward fashion, must include the sun. And if there is no sun, then they must, it seems to me, mean something else. They must be being used in another way, which then leaves open the possibility that the word day is being used in another way for the purposes of the author. And why don't you pick it up from there as you're looking at the cultural context and what these authors are trying to accomplish in light of the cultural situation?
Yeah, I guess for me the issue, and even in the book, the issue is not as much whether it's a literal day or figurative day yet, because in thinking about the days and in thinking about the events, what I discovered is particularly in Egypt, when an Israelite in that time period heard this story, knowing what all the ancient Egyptian accounts were, which, by the way, go back long before this was written,
mm-hmm.
They would have said, yeah, that sounds very familiar. Those events sound familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Leaving the days aside for a moment, those events sound like what I would have expected, because we know, or we have heard, that the gods, in this case, depending mm-hmm. on which god you're talking about in Egypt,
mm-hmm.
they created and there became this bubble of light and order, and light existed before the sun. That's an ancient world concept. That's not just Egypt. That's everywhere. Mm-hmm. There's light. That's a separate entity, not just the sun. And it was separated, and the waters were separated, and all these things happened. But their world picture is still very much intact. God didn't say, this is not what you should see. You really ought to see a ball floating in space.
Mm-hmm.
So now what he does, though, and one of the things that is different about Genesis 1 is that it puts it into a framework of six creative days plus a seventh day mm-hmm. of rest. And that really becomes a bigger question than just, is this figurative or literal? Is this intended to say consecutive 24-hour periods mm-hmm. or something else? Because you have to ask the question, what on earth is he doing with 7 days? And knowing that the events basically are following an Egyptian order of events and set of events, and yet he's adding 7 days to it, I think it becomes somewhat different than we expect. And I'm driven to a conclusion that God isn't so much concerned about the how. He's not dealing with trying to change their idea of what happened. He's using what they assume from their world picture, that there is a solid dome up there and there's water up there and that the edges of the mountains maybe are holding it up or something else. There's different ways they saw it. But
mm-hmm.
all of that, he's saying, I'm not going to try to correct that, but I am going to try to correct the reality of who created this.
Mm-hmm.
And so he drives them to that. Now, the 7 days then becomes, actually, I think it is involved in some of this polemic that you mentioned, although I think Genesis 1 is far more than polemic. It's not just trying to argue against their gods, but it is actually teaching a very strong theology of who Yahweh is.
Mm-hmm.
And it also is showing a radically different view of history, because in Egyptian thought, every day is recreation. Every day mm-hmm. when the sun comes up, you say, oh, wow, the god survived another night. We have a new day, and we're not going to just go back into nothingness again, which was their mm-hmm. ultimate view of history, mm-hmm. sort of circular. Whereas in biblical history, as God is presenting creation, it is teleological. It's moving towards the end, and his end is rest, and mm-hmm. seventh day is significant. So it's a very different view of the process. So, yeah, days then become probably not, at least in my understanding, probably not intending at all to say this is six 24-hour periods with a seventh following, as much as it is trying to present a theology of who God is and what his view of history is and how all this functions. Mm-hmm. And that then becomes much more symbolic, which is actually quite common in the ancient world as well, both in creation accounts and outside of it.
Hmm. Well, so, okay, well, that raises other questions for me. One is, if you noted in your book, and you just mentioned it, the similarities with the Egyptian cosmology and the biblical cosmology, the particular details, the wording, there's a lot of similarity. It turns out you also have the same thing in the Canaanite and the Mesopotamian accounts. And now, this has always raised a question for me. It sounds to me like you're suggesting, on the one hand, God is kind of working with an ancient story, and instead of correcting the scientific historic details of the ancient story, he's inserting himself into that story to make a different point. Would that be a fair, at least as far as we've discussed this, would that be a fair way of putting your broad view of this?
Yeah, I hate to say, I don't want to say he's just borrowing their story. I don't think that's quite accurate, because he is borrowing the details of the events. But the story is so much bigger than that. And their story is so tied to the deities, because mm-hmm. every aspect of creation as it comes into being is a new set of deities.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the God of the sky and the God of the heavens and the God of the land. And all these aspects are really deities to the Egyptians, and it's so different for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to say it's borrowing, because I think the dramatic differences we must not miss. But I think for us, probably for most of us, the similarities are the most striking,
mm-hmm.
because we've never thought in those terms before. We've always thought, well, this is very different.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
now we're thinking, well, maybe it's not as different as we thought. And yet, on the other hand, I think the differences that we see are so easy for us to underestimate because it seems so familiar to us.
Yeah, I think one point that you made that jumped out at me was just the fact that the sun comes up on this fourth day. It's not central. It comes, you know, through after a couple of the quote-unquote days, however you want to characterize that. It's not front and center.
Right.
And it's doesn't have a name.
Right.
It's just a thing used for a practical purpose. And
yeah.
So there is this deifying of the natural elements, which strike me as a very important point that's being made in this narrative. Now, of course, that doesn't speak, though, to whether the narrative is a chronology or not. And I'm wondering if, have you thought about, given the similarities with all of these other ancient cosmologies, do you think that maybe there was, this does reflect some kind of chronology, and it was picked up by all these other cultures simply because the story is retold in the cultures, and so that's how it's kind of like the flood. There was a flood, and therefore this influences flood stories with, though there are variations, it seemed to suggest there was an original flood that gets a little bit corrupted in the retelling in different cultures, but it goes back to the original. And in this case, it could be that this sequence of events that we see that are similar in all these stories are really part of the ancient original sequence, but are just paganized in the process of the retelling by these pagan cultures.
Well, it's possible. I've been asked that question a lot, and I understand the significance of it, because it would be much easier to take that way, I think, if we could say, well, this goes back to an original story, it's passed on by oral tradition, and so what we're really seeing is God correcting what they have corrupted.
Yeah.
The problem with that I see, and it's possible, but we don't have any oral tradition to hang that on,
mm-hmm.
but and as we look at the other traditions, the events in Mesopotamia are not clear, are not nearly as precise as they are in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And in Canaan, we just don't have enough information to tell you a whole lot about it.
Mm-hmm.
But what I am concerned about, or at least one of the things that I think makes it a little harder to see it quite that way, is that in telling the story, these details of the solid creation, if you want to call it that, the ordering of the stuff in creation,
mm-hmm.
really fit in with their world picture. And basically, it seems as if the telling of that story and all of that in the ancient world is supporting a picture of the world of the universe, if you will, mm-hmm. in which the Earth is a flat disk, and you've got mountains holding up the dome of the sky, and you've got waters above the sky, and you've got waters beneath, and it's on pillars, and we see that same sort of picturesque language in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
But what God isn't doing in that is he's not saying in Genesis 1, wait a minute, you've got this all wrong, you're seeing the world wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He never refutes that. He does give the same events, but he doesn't stop and say, but wait a minute, you're misunderstanding these things. So does that mean that there was a set of events in that same order and they've just totally misunderstood what it is? Or could it be that those perceptions of creation have arisen from that understanding, that picture of the world, and he's just not concerned enough to say, let me explain it to you? Because quite honestly, not only could they not have understood it if you'd given them a scientific explanation,
right.
I don't know if we still could.
Well, if the word scientific was replaced with the word historical, and this is the way I kind of, my inclination is that clearly the Genesis account is not meant to be a scientific characterization the way scientists might characterize certain type of events. But it could still be, though it lacks that language, it still could be an historical chronology that one has access through with science to be able to assess. And I think this is the way both the young earthers and the old earthers have taken it.
Right.
As an historical chronology, and young earthers will say, we're taking it at face value, and if you got some science to back up our view, fine. Old earthers are going to say, well, science does speak to that clearly. It says this, and we are kind of accommodating, we're trying to accommodate the our interpretation to what the science says in some measure. And you're saying that both of those are misguided because this isn't a chronology in that sense at all.
I do think that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it is necessary to try to either connect science to the text or the text to science. I think mm-hmm. both are misunderstanding our purpose of exegesis, but also I think they're misunderstanding, in both cases, biblical chronology. And I do make the point in the book that as we look at the rest of the Old Testament, what we consider historical accounts, which I believe are historical, are not nearly as concerned with chronology as we are.
That's right. Right.
So whether we're looking at Genesis 2 or we're looking at the book of Samuel or we're looking at most of the rest of the Old Testament, there's lots of dischronologization mm-hmm. where you have things that are just not in order chronologically.
Because there's a thematic concern.
Thematic, theological, absolutely.
Right, right. Okay.
And you can see that over and over again.
Well, you're getting everybody thinking, I'll tell you that, John. We got to go to break. I'll come back in just a moment. Again, the book is In the Beginning, We Misunderstood Interpreting Genesis 1 in Its Original Context. I'm Greg Kokel, and this is Stand to Reason.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
The abortion choice position is flawed on many levels. I talk about a disturbing inconsistency in the view in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Find it on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? str.org is a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for. Before you turn to Google, log on to str.org, and you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse the range of topics, from our radio archives to advanced online training to our blog. you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from STR.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ and the tactics that will help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. Your visit to STR.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you take a stand for the truth. So visit today. That's STR.org.
Greg Kokel, your host here on Stand to Reason, with you every Sunday from 2 until 5, and that'll be changing in March, where the live show will be broadcast sometime in March on Tuesdays from 4 to 7, so that's where your calls will be directed. Of course, we'll give you more information about that in the future, but I want to get back to my guest, John Soden, the author of In the Beginning We Misunderstood, Interpreting Genesis 1 in its Original Context. And this is a kind of a game-changing approach for a lot of folks listening here. It's a paradigm shift, maybe being considered by some people, as, at least as they reflect on the kinds of things that you've said, John. That thinking about Genesis 1 in terms of chronology that can then be blended or married to a kind of a scientific analysis is just missing the point of the text. It wasn't intended to be understood that way. Were you going to jump in there and say something? Or?
Yeah, well, just, you know, I guess the only thing I want to add to that is just, I don't think the chronology is a... So it's a significant issue, but I don't think there's enough evidence to say so, and to me, it's not necessary.
Okay. All right. So, but then that does raise the question. Now, there's two questions that get raised here, and one of them is, does that leave room for people then on the other side, let's say on more extreme, let's just say theistic evolutionist. I don't know where you stand on that issue, and that doesn't matter for our interview, but it is something that's in play here in discussion, and where there are people who are going to want to say, well, look, we believe in God and we believe in the Bible, but you know what? Science tells us how this happened. It's really Darwinism, and you know, man evolved according to the Darwinian process, and so Genesis is just kind of a metaphor. And the science tells you what actually took place. That's one objection that's going to be raised. I'd like you to respond to. And well, why don't we offer that and see what you have to say, and then I have another question regarding that.
Sure. Well, as I read Genesis 1, it's not dealing with those issues, which means that if we're going to refute evolution, or whether you're talking about a naturalistic evolution or a theistic evolution, mm-hmm. which I think makes a significant difference. But still, if you're going to refute one or the other or both, you'll need to do it on other grounds. I just don't see Genesis 1 as being the crux that's going to say, well, therefore you can't have a particular view.
Okay, well, this brings me to the second question, because it does seem that when it comes to Genesis 2 and 3, that the details there do bear on the question of historicity or chronology, and the one argument, one concern with regards to theistic evolution, depending on how it's construed, is that if you remove the possibility of an actual historical Adam who is the father of the human race, that is right. All of ours, and so you don't have common descent from Adam as the original humans, then this has profound theological impact.
Right.
Okay, good. You see the concern there. Let's talk about that, and also about how then do you jump from a non-chronological account in Genesis 1 to a chronological account in Genesis 2 and 3?
Or maybe I would say a less chronological account to a more chronological account.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
Because,
I'm interested to hear.
Well, you jump into Genesis 2, and it's not exactly chronological either, because if all you had was Genesis 2, and you're reading it in the Hebrew, you would assume then that the animals and the birds are created after Adam.
Yeah.
So it's not exactly a chronological account there either.
Right.
Now, I would agree. I think you do have...
But it is a history. It is a kind of a more hard and
exactly.
fast history, would you say?
Yeah, I think there is a shift there, and I think I think there's several shifts that we see in Genesis, and one of the shifts, I would say, occurs there in Genesis 2:4, where we do have that first toledot, where we begin now with the This is what happened to the heavens and the earth in the day they were created. And so after the introduction of Genesis 1:1 to 2:3, we have the account that goes back and backs up and said, okay, let's talk a little bit about what God is doing with Adam and Adam's purpose in the garden and what how this is relating to where you are today. And so it becomes much more of what we would consider to be more historical.
Okay, can I ask a quick question at this point?
Sure.
So part of what justifies the transition there in your mind is not just the Toledoth, where we have kind of a new chapter beginning, and so the genre in a certain sense can change, arguably, but you also have... you're going from the information in Genesis 1, which was not, you're arguing, it's not meant to give us all this detail of how the events all took place and got formed together, but it's really meant to establish the proper supremacy of the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob over against all these other pagan gods. That's the most important thing there. And then you get into the story of, okay, who's man, what's his problem, how do you fix it, which is the issue of the rest of the Bible. And so that's why when you get into after 2:6 or whatever, 2:4 or whatever, you are now you're getting into the real meat where we've got to be particular and specific because this is the stuff that makes a difference for everything else. Would that be a fair way of describing the disjuncture there?
I think that is part of what's going on there. I think we do see a shift there in terms of what he's talking about, both in subject matter but also in the way he's dealing with it.
Okay.
There is still a tremendous amount of comparative materials as we look at those. So, and I mentioned in the book, even in Egypt, man is created on a potter's wheel. We see a word there, Yetzar, in Genesis 2, that God formed man of the dust of the earth. So that alludes to that sort of thing. The breath of life, you know, just the image of God even in Genesis 1, all of those sorts of things are similarities. So we have to recognize some of that familiar vocabulary in their context as well. But I still think both in the forming of man and woman in his image in Genesis 1 and then the formation of Adam and Eve in Genesis 2, as well as the theological issues, I think in the rest of the scriptures we still have to really deal with the whole issue of historical Adam.
Mm-hmm. So principally, we're looking at an historical account, even though like lots of historical accounts, there, you know, everything isn't all tidy necessarily. That's not the point. We're really talking about actual events. Part of what I ask myself is, you know, had I been there, what would I have seen?
Right.
And probably what you're saying is probably not, if I were there would during the events of Genesis recorded in Genesis 1, if they were events, well, I wouldn't have seen what a lot of people think I would have seen, all of these things, because those weren't actually events in that same sense. This is more something else is going on there. But in Genesis 2 and following, there we actually have an historical state of affairs where certain things are happening that are really important that they be historical.
Yeah, and I think our understanding of history, unfortunately, is very modern. And so when we say historical, we mean one thing, and I'm not sure the ancients would have understood quite the same.
Well,
so
do you mean in the way we
creation historical? Sure.
Do you mean in the way that we tell our history, like in chronology, for example, that's how we report it now, but or as opposed to understanding at its core, history represents something that actually took place.
Right.
Would
well,
you say that they
first,
share that?
The first.
Okay, but
yeah,
they do
no,
share
I'd agree
that.
With you.
Okay, good. Tell me then what and I'm jumping kind of towards the end here because we got about 5 minutes left in our conversation, which has been really, really stimulating for me, John. So this is I haven't completed the book, but I'm gonna jump to the end because
okay.
The chapters there are provocative. You have a chapter on truth and chronology, and this is a little bit what we've been talking about. But you also have a chapter on the meanings of day and death. Can we talk about death first?
Sure.
This is a very controversial issue with regards to the age of the earth and Romans 5 and stuff like that. What do you say in that chapter?
What I basically say is we have assumed that both in Romans 5, 1 Corinthians 15, that because through Adam, death entered the world, we assume that that's death for everything. But the text is really talking about death for Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't say that it was death for everything. Mm-hmm. So our assumption is that there was no death anywhere until Adam and Eve. But I'm not convinced that the scriptures support that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that actually is not required for our understanding of Genesis 1.
Mm-hmm.
But it's such a significant issue in terms of the age of the earth and how we're going to deal with these texts, especially Genesis 2 and 3,
mm-hmm.
that we felt like it was something that we ought to at least jump into a little bit.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to looking at that more carefully, but that's been my conviction that Romans 5 is addressing a narrow circumstance. And then one has it strikes me the impractical kind of circumstance that if nothing died before Adam sinned and God really did not want Adam to sin, that he actually created a world of creatures that reproduce at rapid rates with no expectation that any would ever die.
And there's very difficult.
There was a guy named Malthus that talked about that back in the 19th century, and you know, you just got bodies piled upon bodies, you know, all over the earth. If that's the case, and that just is hard to imagine. So,
right.
What has the reception of this book been in your circles?
Positive so far. I certainly have my detractors. There are some that just can't believe it's not motivated by science,
mm-hmm.
and that. That I'm not denigrating the inspiration and authority of Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, it's been very positive. I think people, as we've had opportunity to discuss it and people have understood it, they have certainly thought more, and
mm-hmm.
that's been good. And my intent is to think about these issues.
Well, as far as denigrating the inspiration and authority of Scripture, in your defense here for anybody thinking about that, the whole point that you're being made is what is the accurate way to read the Word that God, through His Spirit, has given us?
Mm-hmm.
It is not whether it's reliable, it's whether we are reading it properly, and then you bring, I think, the proper hermeneutical questions to the table. And I'm a little embarrassed that though I championed those same principles, I have never asked the question, you know, who's writing and to whom is he writing and what is their sits and leave, and, you know, what's happening for them and their culture and everything that might be spoken to here. And I found that the details in that I've read so far have been very helpful in helping me position the writing, at least, more properly in that sense.
Great.
With the culture and the like. So I thank you for the interview and the conversation together, and wish you all the best, sir.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate the opportunity. Blessings on you.
Thank you. Dr. John Soden, in the beginning, we misunderstood interpreting Genesis 1 in its original context. There's a lot here. It's certainly controversial for many people, but I'd like to recommend it to you to get a copy of it and read it and pay attention to what he says. I found myself sitting straight up in the chair when I read the first couple chapters, because there are certain elements in this that made so much sense to me. I think Genesis 1 represents a very difficult piece of biblical writing to understand, precisely because it's so old and so many cultural things are going on. But I think Dr. Soden and Dr. Miller are asking the questions in the right way, even if we don't come to the same conclusions that they come to. Well, that's it for our show today, except for to mention the piece on our website I'd like you to take a look at. It's called Abortion and Human Rights. And in this piece, I explore the issue of abortion kind of as a parallel to slavery. Something to think about. Anyway, there it is, SDR.org. And that's all our time, friends. You go out and give them heaven this week, all right? I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.